Now we come to the last chapter of this book, and it is 20th Century Criticism, I.A. Richards, Textual and Psychological Approach. The first subheading is Importance of His Work. Ivor Armstrong Richards is one of those great critics of the modern age who have exercised considerable influence on both sides of Atlantic. As a matter of fact, both T.S. Eliot and I.A. Richards are pioneers in the field of New Criticism, though they differ sharply from each other in certain important respects. I.A. Richards has influenced a number of critics on both sides of Atlantic. Such new critics as John Crow Ransom, Kenneth Burke, Clint Brooks, R.P. Blackmore, Robert Penn Warren, William Empson, despite differences in their theory and practice, have repeatedly acknowledged their indebtedness to him. I.A. Richards is the first-rate critic since Coleridge, who has formulated a systematic and complete theory of poetry, and his views are highly original and illuminating. Like Coleridge, Richards is a man of wide learning. He is widely read not only in literature, but also in philosophy, psychology, aesthetics, the fine arts, and the broad principles of the various sciences. He has used all his stupendous learning for the compounding of an amazingly new and original poetics. Indeed, Coleridge is the only great critic with whom he may fittingly be compared. Then the next subheading is his career. Born in 1893, he was educated at Cambridge, where in 1919 he was also appointed as a professor of English literature. Thus began a long and distinguished career both as teacher and critic. He lectured both in Cambridge and Harvard, and thus could influence the course of literary criticism in both the countries. His first work, written in collaboration with C.K. Ogdon, was published in 1922. This was followed by The Meaning of Meaning, 1923, also written in collaboration with Ogdon, O.G.D.O.N. The Principles of Literary Criticism, 1924, is one of his major works in which he has put the best of his, and which was at once hailed as a highly original work likely to give an entire new orientation to critical theory. This was followed in 1929 by his The Practical Criticism, which shows him as an unrivaled advocate and practitioner of practical criticism. The work puts to the test the new theories propounded by him and also clarifies and illuminates his theories. Science and Poetry, Coleridge on Imagination, Mencius of the Mind, The Philosophy of Rhetoric, and Speculative Instruments are some of his other works. The next subheading in this chapter is His Technique and Basic Principles. A study of his The Practical Criticism, A Study of Literary Judgment, reveals that I.A. Richards is a staunch advocate of a close textual and verbal study and analysis of a work of art. While preparing this book, the author had three things in mind. I have set three aims before me in constructing this book, he says. first to introduce a new kind of documentation to those who are interested in the contemporary state of culture, whether as critics, as philosophers, as teachers, as psychologists, or merely as curious persons. Secondly, to provide a new technique for those who wish to discover for themselves what they think and feel about poetry, and why they should like or dislike it. Thirdly, to prepare the way for educational methods more efficient than those who use now in developing discrimination and the power to understand what we hear and read. His approach is pragmatic and empirical. In order to ascertain the responses of fairly cultured readers, he distributed among his Cambridge students printed sheets containing 12 poems and invited their comments. The names of the poets and all the other information about them was carefully withheld. The comments of the students were then analyzed, and Professor Richards gave his own comments, suggestions, and interpretations and conclusions, and these are incorporated in the third part of the book. The work is a landmark in the history of literary criticism, and ever since verbal and textual analysis, interpretation, and evaluation on the basis of such analysis have become the basis of literary appreciation. I.A. Richards, by his own work, has made literary criticism factual, scientific, and complete. It no longer remains a matter of the application of set rules or mere intuition or impressions. His factual and scientific method of critical analysis, interpretation, and evaluation have exercised considerable influence on the new critics on both sides of the Atlantic. A stress on close textual analysis. This is the next subheading. A study of his practical criticism together with his work, The Meaning of Meaning, reveals his great interest in textual and verbal analysis. A poet writes to communicate, and language is the means of that communication. Language is made of words, and hence a study of words is all important if we are to understand the meaning of a work of art. Words carry four kinds of meaning, or to be more precise, the total meaning of a word depends upon four factors. These are sense, feelings, tone, and intention. By sense is meant something that is communicated by the plain literal meanings of the words. Feeling refers to emotions, emotional attitudes, will, desire, pleasure, unpleasure, and the rest. When we say something, we have a feeling about it, an attitude towards it, some special direction, bias, or acceleration of interest towards it, some personal flavor or coloring of feeling. Words express these feelings, these nuances of interest. By tone is meant that writer's attitude to his reader. The writer chooses his words and arranges them, keeping in mind the kind of readers likely to read his work. There is a relation between the writer and his reader, and the tone reflects the awareness of his relation. Feeling is only a state of the mind. It does not imply an object, but intention has an object. Intention is the writer's aim, which may be conscious or unconscious. It refers to the effect one tries to produce. This purpose modifies the expression. It controls the emphasis, shapes the arrangement, or draws attention to something of importance. Richards says, originally, language may have been almost purely emotive, that is to say, a means of expressing feelings about situations, a means of expressing impersonal attitudes, and a means of bringing about concerned action. In poetry, language returns to that primitive condition. Language of poetry affects feelings. The statements in poetry are there as a means to the manipulation and expression of feelings and attitudes. Hence, we must avoid an intuitive reading and also an over-literal reading of poems. Words in poetry have an emotive value, and the figurative language used by poets conveys those emotions effectively and forcefully. The next subheading of this chapter is the context, its importance. Words also acquire a rich associative value through their use by different poets in different contexts. The context in which a word has been used is all important. Words have different meanings in different contexts. Words are symbols or signs, and they deliver their full meaning only in a particular context. They work in association and within particular context. He writes, a context is a set of entities, that is, things or events related in a certain way. These entities have each a character such that other sets of entities occur having the same characters and related by the same relation, and these occur nearly uniformly. Meaning is dependent on context, but the context may not always be apparent and easily perceptible. Literary compositions are characterized by rich complexity in which certain links are suppressed for concentration of effective and forceful expression. Frequent mention is therefore made of the missing context and ambiguity. In ordinary speech, such omissions and consequent ambiguities are regarded as blemishes in writing, but in poetry or even in artistic prose, they are a source of embellishment and a means of effective communication of meaning. The literary critic is expected to understand and expand the context so that the poem may become intelligible and its full value may be grasped. Words have different meanings in different contexts. Sense and feeling have a mutual dependence. The sound of a word has much to do with the feeling it evokes. First, the feeling may arise from the meaning and be governed by it. The feeling is the result of grasping the meaning. Secondly, the meaning arises from the feelings evoked. Thus, the word gorgeous first generates a feeling from its very sounds. Thirdly, sense and feeling may be related because of the context. A complete poem can influence a single word or phrase contained in it either through the feelings or through the sense. The feelings already occupying the mind limit the possibilities of the new words. This is because words are ambiguous in themselves, and they acquire new meanings when they are charged with feelings. Hence, Richards argues that we need one careful reading to find the meaning and another to grasp the feeling. The next subheading is rhythm and meter, their significance. The meaning of words is also determined by rhythm and meter. Rhythm results from the repetition of particular sounds and the expectancy this repetition arouses in the mind. Meter is a specialized form of rhythm. It is rhythm made more regular and cast into shape and well-formed pattern. Both rhythm and meter are organic and integral parts of a poem, for they both determine the meaning of the words used by the poets. Richard's remarks in this connection are interesting and deserved to be quoted in their entirety. Rhythm and its specialized form, meter, depends upon repetition and expectancy. Equally, where what is expected recurs and where it fails, all rhythmical and metrical effects spring from anticipation. As a rule, this anticipation is unconscious. Sequences of syllables, both as sounds and as images of speech movements, leave the mind ready for certain further sequences rather than others. Our momentary organization is adapted to one range of possible stimuli rather than to another. Just as the eye reading print unconsciously expects the spelling to be as usual and the font of type be remain the same, so the mind, after reading a line or two of words or half a sentence of prose, prepares itself ahead for any one of a number of possible sequences, at the same time negatively incapacitating itself for others. We may turn now to that more complex and more specialized form of temporal rhythmic sequence, which is known as meter. This is the means by which words may be made to influence one another to the greatest possible extent. In metrical reading, the narrowness and definiteness of expectancy, as much unconscious as ever in most cases, is very greatly increased, reaching in some cases, if rhyme also is used, almost exact precision. Furthermore, what is anticipated becomes, through the regularity of the time intervals in meter, virtually dated. This is no mere matter of more or less perfect correspondence with the beating of some internal metronome. Rhythm, meter, and meaning cannot be separated. They form together a single system. They are not separate entities but organically related. Therefore, a prose paraphrase or an over-literal reading can never convey the total meaning of a poem. The next subheading is Poetic Truth, Its Nature. Successive readings are necessary to understand the poetic meaning. Poetic truth is different from scientific truth. It is a matter of emotional belief rather than intellectual belief. It is not a matter of verification but of attitude and emotional reaction. In the Principles of Literary Criticism, he writes, "It is evident that the bulk of poetry consists of statements which only the very foolish would think of attempting to verify. They are not the kind of things which can be verified." If we recall what was said in chapter 16 as to the natural generality or vagueness of reference, we shall see another reason why references, as they occur in poetry, are rarely susceptible of scientific truth or falsity. Only references which are brought into certain highly complex and very special combinations so as to correspond to the ways in which things actually hang together can be either true or false, and most references in poetry are not knit together in this way. But even when they are, on examination, frankly false, this is no defect. Unless indeed the obviousness of the falsity forces the reader to reactions which are incongruent or disturbing to the poem. And equally, a point more often misunderstood, their truth when they are true is no merit. The next subheading is the value of metaphors. For the purposes of communication, the use of metaphoric language is all important. A metaphor is a shift, a carrying over of a word from its normal use to a new use. Metaphors may be of two kinds. First, sense metaphors, and second, emotive metaphors. In a sense metaphor, the shift is due to a similarity or analogy between the original object and the new one. In an emotive metaphor, the shift is due to a similarity between the feelings, the new situation, and the normal situation aroused. The same word in different contexts may be a sense metaphor or an emotive one. Metaphor, says Richards, is a semi-surreptitious method by which a greater variety of elements can be brought into the fabric of the experience. With the help of a metaphor, the writer can crowd into the poem much more than would be possible otherwise. The metaphorical meaning arises from the interrelations of sense, tone, feeling, and intention. A metaphor is a point at which many very different influences may cross or unite. Hence, its dangers in prose discussions and its treacherousness for careless readers of poetry, but hence, at the same time, its peculiar quasi-magical sway in the hands of a master. Certain conductions of metaphors through their history, partly and through the collocations of emotional influences that by their very ambiguity they effect, have a power over our minds that nothing also can exert or perpetuate. The next subheading is A New Critic with a Difference. I.A. Richards is at one with the new critics in his stress on close textual and verbal study of a poem. His study of words as means of communication and his stress on their fourfold meaning and on the way in which meaning is determined by rhythm and meter are original and striking and have gone a long way towards shaping the course of literary criticism in the 20th century, both in England and America. His critical methods, verbal and structural analysis, interpretation and evaluation of a work of art, started the vogue of experimentation and analysis in literary criticism. He challenged both intuitive cursory reading as well as over-literal reading, and has in this way given a new orientation both to the teaching of literature and literary criticism. By his insistence on verbal analysis through T.S. Eliot sneered at it as lemon squeezing. He has revealed new and unexpected meanings, and in the words he has studied, has turned verbal and structural analysis into an interesting and fruitful techniques. In all these respects, I.A. Richards, along with T.S. Eliot, may be called the founding father of New Criticism. He has been a constant source of inspiration to the New Critics, more particularly to John Crow, Ransom, and William Ampson, many of whom have used his tools and techniques on an extensive scale, but he differs from the New Critics in one important respect. While the New Critics limit themselves rigorously to the poem under consideration, I.A. Richards also takes into account its effects on the readers. For him, the real value of a poem lies in the reactions and attitudes it creates, and whether or not it is conducive to greater emotional balance, equilibrium, peace, and rest in the mind of the readers. For him, the value of a work of art lies in its power to harmonize and organize complex and varying human impulses into patterns that are lasting and pleasurable. In the view of the New Critics, all such considerations are extrinsic and they come in the way of the appreciation and evaluation of work of art as it is in itself. Then the next subheading, his psychological approach. Thus Richards is a New Critic with a difference, and the difference arises from his keen interest in psychology. His interest in psychology will be best brought out by a brief consideration of his views on the value of art and the function of tragedy. There are conflicting instincts and desires, or appetencies, as he calls them, in the human mind. Man is often torn between conflicting pulls from different directions, and consequently, he suffers from mental uneasiness. The main function of art is to enable human mind to organize itself more quickly and completely than it could do otherwise. In short, art is a means whereby we can gain emotional balance, mental equilibrium, peace, and rest. What is true of the individual is also true of society. A society in which arts are freely cultivated exhibits better mental and emotional tranquility than the societies in which arts are not valued. Harmony is produced by the work of art in that it stimulates usually opposed aspects of being, keen thought, yet strong feeling, fear, yet calm, CALM. Equilibrium among these is maintained in that there is no desire nor action, only a poised awareness, a general intensification and consciousness, exercising all a man's faculties and together. In this way is produced a state of mind in which all the faculties are alive and active, and pleasure results from their harmonious adjustment. All the complex thoughts, feelings, and desires which are stimulated are simultaneously put into an ordered pattern leading to mental peace and pleasure. This harmonization of varying impulses accounts for the pleasure which arises from reading or witnessing a great tragedy. Tragic pleasure, calm of mind, all passion spent, does not result from purgation of any impulse or impulses. It results from a harmonization of opposite impulses. In this way, I.A. Richards uses his knowledge of psychology to resolve the age-old controversy regarding the sources of tragic pleasure and the nature of tragic catharsis. Friends, in this way we come to the end of this chapter, that is 20th Century Criticism, I.A. Richards. And in this way we come to the end of this whole book as well. धन्यवाद.